Hey guys, welcome back to the Prehistoric Life podcast. And today, as you see, we got multiple people here. We have a Fossil Shack and Rex Creek Discovery. Would y'all guys like to reintroduce yourself? Whoever wants to go first.
Take it off, Seth.
All right. So Seth Sorensen, I'm the owner of Fossil Shack and co-owner of American Fossil. Happy to be back.
And I'm Riley Lawson. I am the owner of Rex Creek Discoveries. And I'm just a bone digger and a preparator and all the sorts. Thanks for having me back, Eric.
No problem. I love having y'all on. And there's Fossil Shack's Instagram account if you want to go check that out. And I'll pull it up in a second. Hang on. There's Rex Creek Discoveries. Instagram channel. Go check those out. They have a lot of amazing content. So y'all have been to the Tucson Fossil Show. I don't really know what the official name is.
Tucson, Gem, Mineral. Yeah, you can call it whatever you want.
And y'all were two people that I already had contact with that I know of that had actual displays. So I guess we can start with you, Seth. I mean, would you like to talk about what you had and what you witnessed and what you experienced?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great. Tucson's always a lot of fun. It's someplace that if you've never been, it's really hard to wrap your mind around, because you can talk about it as a gem and mineral show or fossil show. But really what it is a conglomerate of over 50 show venues. And at some of those venues, there are several hundred vendors. And some of those individual vendors have booths that are, larger than my house. So it's like nothing you've ever seen or experienced. And it's better than going to any museum in the world, because here everything's for sale. And to me, that's the best part. So you get to walk around and just see some incredible things. We set up at a show called the Mineral and Fossil Marketplace, which is on Oracle. We've set up there since really that show began. And we're there with a bunch of other, fossil nerds, and the fossil folks, we all kind of gather together. We've got, Fossil Alley is another location. You'll hear about that in a minute, but, the fossil folks, we like to stick together. So, when you find one, you'll typically find multiple of us. And, our booth set up, we have, a lot of what we have, probably 50% of what we sell, at our show are the, fossil fish that come from our quarry in Wyoming, Green River formation. But then I do a lot with Pleistocene material. I bring in a lot of Pleistocene material from Alaska that's found by the placer miners up there. I do a lot of work with tusks and mammoth material. And so we have a lot of that kind of material. We have meteorites. I have a lot of good friends that are meteorite hunters. And so, I'm always picking up meteorites for them. So we do a little bit of everything. I've developed some of my own fossil preparation tools. We've got our own line of scribes and a lot of different things like glues and, polyvinyl acetate, all those kind of products that we developed and sell. And so you can find a little bit of everything at our booth. And so it's fun because we get people from a lot of different walks of life that come through. We have our perennial buyers that come in every year from, all over the world. We have buyers from as far away as China and the Netherlands and, Sweden, Canada. They're there every year. And, we typically have their materials already boxed or packaged, ready to go when they show up. So, they don't even have to really spend a lot of time other than looking at maybe a few of the higher end items, and they load it up and they're off. And then we'll have, just your random person off the street that stops by and they're looking for something for a few bucks and seeing what we have. And a lot of those people, believe it or not, are after the coprolite that we bring down. We Utah is actually a really great source of that. We have a lot of private property here that has Jurassic coprolite, and so it polishes up beautifully, and we sell the crap out of it. Can I say that? I can say that, right? I kept it to crap. So, it's a lot of fun. And then we get to go around and visit with friends. That's possibly the most favorite part of the show for me, is just seeing our friends from all over the world. You know, we've got our friends from here in the country that we really don't get to see very often. And then friends that we see once a year that come from, you know, places like Lebanon or France or, you name it, they're coming from all over the world, and it's really fun to catch up and see them and, you know, maybe go to lunch or go to dinner with them and catch up on what they've been, you know, doing in life and projects they're working on. Yeah, a lot of fun. So I probably spend more time than I should. I abandon our booth quite often and spend a lot of time out visiting, because, you know, you can do that. And it's great. I mean, we even spend a little bit of time, talking fossils. So it's been a lot of fun. Probably my favorite time of the year. It beats Christmas, I think, by a lot.
I can see why. It seems like a lot of fun, and I really got to get out there one day for one of them, at least.
Yep. I think everybody should do it at least once.
Gotta add to the bucket list. Yeah. So, I mean, would you like to talk about what you – how do I point? That way. I'll just do that. Would you like to talk about what you had going on?
So I was set up at the Mineral and Fossil Alley, also known as the Days Inn Show. I had primarily Cretaceous, vertebrate fossils from the Hell Creek and the Lance Creek, along with a few other odds and ends. I'm a big mammal guy, so I had a display case full of mammal fossils. But I think Seth summed it up pretty good with the whole international kind of vibe. Like, it's really neat how you meet people from just dozens of different countries, and you meet people from anywhere from locals with families who want a little bone chunk for their child's collection, all the way up to, you know, gallery owners who want a T-Rex skull. It's a lot of fun. It was my first year doing the show, so it was kind of a learning curve for me. Need to bring a little bit more variety next year. It was a great show, made a lot of contacts.
And you did have one of the coolest pieces there. You should tell them about your Rex block.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Seth. Yeah. So in my micro channel deposit in the Hell Creek formation, there is it's a very well sorted gravel deposit. So the site is actually located on like a 15 degree slope. And that's depositional. That's not due to uplift. So, the gravel almost sorted itself like a gold sluice in a way. So in the upper areas of the deposit, I found dozens of more than dozens, hundreds of gar scales, little fish bones, unidentifiable flakes.
Sections.
And then once you kind of get down into the mid-level of the slope, there were a lot of larger bone chunks from, like hadrosaurs and ceratopsians, larger stuff. And it's all due to density. And then in the lowest part of the slope, kind of where the deposit ended, basically, I found mostly T-Rex teeth. And they were very concentrated together. And you can almost think of it like it was deposited along the bank of a creek. So like in the upper zone, that was shallow water where the flow was the lowest.
You got all the smaller animals, and it's just kind of a surface level.
Yeah. These were all bones from dead creatures at the time when they were deposited. So really it just comes down to water flow. And then so like in the midsection, that was slightly faster water. So it would wash away the thin stuff and leave the bigger chunks. And then in the lowest section of the deposit, that's actually where the sand pinched out. That's where all the super dense fossils like Rex teeth were located. And so with that, there was one zone. It's probably a, you know, like a 2.5 by 2.5 foot block where I found 6 T-Rex teeth.
Wow.
You know, concentrated within that one block. And when I hit the first one, you know, typically you find a tooth, you remove it, you prepare it. It's an individual specimen. But I had already been finding some concentrations of teeth, and I started collecting matrix pieces because I thought they were unique, adds a little bit more context. But as I was excavating this first tooth, and the first tooth actually turned out to be like a 6-inch perfect Rex tooth, just enormous.
Wow.
And so as I was going around that one, I hit another tooth about 1 inch away. And so at that point, I kind of had the feeling that this might be a super concentrated zone. So I spent a few hours removing the sandstone from above, working the overburden back a little further than I usually do. And over the next, you know, like 5-6 hours throughout the day, I uncovered 4 more T-Rex teeth on that block. Yeah. And then so, and go ahead, Seth.
Oh, I was going to say, it's one of the coolest pieces I think I've ever seen.
That's not something you find every day.
No, it's very scarce to find something like that. You know, you're more likely to find a T-Rex skeleton than you are to find 6 unassociated T-Rex teeth like that.
So they were just kind of just there. They weren't like connected to anything. They were just kind of oddly lined up.
Yep. Yeah, the big 6-inch tooth would have been from, you know, a full-grown adult. That tooth is actually larger than any tooth on Stan's skull in terms of girth.
Wow.
So it would have came from a very large T-Rex. And then all the way down to, you know, 1.5-inch juvenile T-Rex tooth, which, you know, some people are for the nano versus T-Rex, but this one is definitely juvenile T-Rex. It's very fat, you know, big serrations. So yeah, teeth from juveniles, teeth from adults.
You kind of got to see like it kind of like the teeth kind of grow up throughout a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And it was just natural like that. That's a very unique situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, a lot of those microchannel deposits, you'll find that it's, you know, anywhere from like 2 inches thick up to like 3-4 inches thick. And that's more kind of standard. You know, it forms in like a continuous stream environment. But my microchannel, it's up to 8 inches thick. And
you'll really find a microchannel.
Yeah. Right. But I found T-Rex teeth literally standing straight up in this channel deposit.
Wow.
And so, and you know, I find teeth that have tons of enamel peel, and that's all pre-depositional. And then I'll find teeth that are pristine. Some of them have roots. So, kind of my theory is, you know, there was a creek or a river that stretched for, you know, X amount of distance, and it had several little gravel banks that had collected these fossils. And then I believe a big flood came through, kind of increased the stream flow, and concentrated all of these fossils into one zone. Because when you find fossils standing straight up, that tells you that it was more of a chaotic, like, pulse of water.
Mm-hmm. Probably not very, it's a very unique situation. So it's probably unlikely that it just kind of just fell over and whatever happened.
Yeah, and just down the road from my site is a world famous quarry called the Ruth Mason Quarry. And a little bit of background, this is in the Hell Creek Formation of South Dakota. And so the Ruth Mason Quarry, they find they've found thousands and thousands of duckbill fossils there. Edmontosaurus, and primarily only Edmontosaurus, I believe. And they believe that was from a major flood event as well. So I, you know, part of me thinks that these two sites might be connected, because they kind of show like kind of an extreme flow of water, as opposed to some of these other sites where you might get one skeleton or a thin layer of gravel.
Have you found any like hadrosaur or edmontosaur bones in your micro in the channel?
Yeah, there's been a good amount of hadrosaur remains. I do have one animal. It appears that it's all these fossils are from one creature. I've found, I think, like 68 juvenile Edmontosaur vertebrae.
Wow.
And even a few of them are articulated. You know, I found a string of 8 articulated. And they'll be found kind of clustered up, and then I won't find any for a few months. And I've also found skull parts, because, you know, like young animals, their skulls aren't fused.
Their skulls aren't, yeah, fused, so they kind of break apart and you find
exactly. So I've found, I think about 75% of a juvenile duckbill skull.
Wow.
And zero duplicate bones. And some of them even fit like perfect, like the jugal perfectly articulates.
See where they connected.
Yeah, so it's kind of uncanny how perfect they articulate. But.
So, I mean, as you grow up, your skull fuses, but how does the jaw work? Does that stay fused, or can you find just the lower jaw, or does that fuse to certain animals, or?
With dinosaurs, typically the pre-dentary, the beak, because, you know, most theropods are different, but most ornithischians kind of share that same trait, where the beak area will be unfused, and then both mandibles will be separate. And then, you know, there's a couple small bones on the back of the mandibles, the, I believe, serangular and quadrate. Those typically aren't fused because these animals have like somewhat of a mechanism that allows them to chew, so their lower jaws won't be fully fused. But yeah, a lot of times you'll find most of the upper skulls all fused together from, you know, like older juveniles, subadults, all the way to adults.
And if not, you just kind of find them not necessarily chunked together, but in a rough same area.
Yeah, yeah, that happens occasionally as well.
So, I mean, I haven't been out finding stuff like that. So, I mean, that's why I'm asking. But, I mean,
yeah.
So it sounded like a massive event. I mean, and this happens once a year. Is it always kind of the same part of the year in that early February kind of area?
The fossil show?
Yes.
Yeah. It runs at the end of January. Or wait, no. Yeah. It's at the beginning of January. It starts in December. Or wait, am I right, Seth?
No, so you were right the first time. It starts kind of the end of January and then through like the first couple of weeks of February.
Yeah. Okay. And so like
very multi-week.
Yeah, so the shows, they have their, you know, like posted date ranges. But what I found out this year is that a lot of people show up a few weeks early.
I can see why.
Yeah, and so all of the shows have different, they overlap. So like some shows will start like, say, you know, January 25th, run to the first. Other shows will start on, you know, like January 29th, run until the 8th of February. So it just takes a little while to figure out that, and, you know, it's a learning experience.
And I mean, clearly I just have you two from the event, and I'm like you said, there was like hundreds of other people. I mean, did you guys see any like really cool exhibits that are like absolutely worth mentioning?
Yeah, I think every year you see a few like that. A good friend of mine who exhibits in the same location as we do had a monstrous pterosaur skull. I mean, this skull was huge.
Yeah, I saw that.
You know, you always see a few dinosaurs. There's a place called the Co-op that's just down the street from us, and they had a couple of really cool skeletons in there. Really nice Green River crocodile, which I happen to be fond of Green River fossils, digging a lot of my time there. And it was a beautiful specimen of a crocodile. So that was one that I think was towards the top of my list. And then you always see a few things that not everyone finds exciting, but, you know, some of us geek out over a little bit, you know, when you come across some really bizarre trilobites that you've never seen before, or, you know, I've found some really cool fossils from Solnhofen, Germany, horseshoe crabs with the trackways. So the crab literally walked along the bottom of the ocean and died, and its trackway is still preserved. And yeah, so a lot of, you know, cool things like that.
So it's one of my favorite thing that I saw at the show. It was at the I believe it was the marketplace. One of the guys who shows up every year, he's kind of known for his Ice Age fossils from, you know, Europe. He had a lot of mummified fossils from, like, you know, the northern regions, kind of over in Siberia and whatnot. And he actually had 3 wolf pups.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had a juvenile woolly rhinoceros skull with most of its, you know, flesh. And it even had the horns, which is super rare. He also had a cave lion jaw. I believe it was a lower jaw, and it had the tongue preserved.
Yeah, so wow. It had the upper skull had the palate still preserved, and the lower jaw had the tongue.
Yeah.
So it was like you, it was just frozen basically, and it barely decayed any.
Yeah, literally freeze dried.
Yep.
Like, you kill a normal lion and freeze it? What is going on here?
Yeah, so like you see things at the show that, you know, you don't see anywhere else, you know, in the world, and that's where a lot of museums go to procure their fossils.
I could see why. And I mean, with the cave lion, I mean, do you think, was it like just the head, or was it like the whole thing?
It was just the head.
Could you see like the eyes, and do you think it could have had like part of the brain still in there? I mean,
No, the eyes typically decay. But I bet there's a little bit of, you know, it's hard to say. There's a chance there's some shriveled up brain matter in there, but, it was partially skeletonized.
So it was kind of decayed before it froze.
Yeah.
That's a very unique, very, I would assume, rare thing to see.
Big time.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. And the, woolly rhino. I mean, I feel like that's, mammoth is cool, but I feel like woolly rhino is like right up there with mammoth.
Big time.
Yep.
I feel like it's not as known as mammoth, because, I mean, everybody knows the mammoth, but the woolly rhinoceros, those, like, you find those horns, that is just something that's just like, that is the trophy of the day.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, those horns are so hard to find preserved like that.
And is there like a reason for that?
Because, you know, the horns, they're made out of keratin, so it's like, it has to be mummified, basically.
So usually you don't find the full horn, but like the core of the horn.
There actually isn't even a core of these horns because, you know, if you look at a skull of a rhinoceros, they just have this like big humping nose. So the horn is like a fingernail, basically. It just
And it's made up of a whole bunch of fibers, almost like thick hair fibers as it goes up. And as those rhino horns start to break down, those hairs just unravel and the horns just, they come apart. So it's really difficult to find those well-preserved unless they happen to have, you know, either frozen right away or, you know, fell into a bog or something that allowed it to stay together without coming apart naturally. So
like the tar pits or just permafrost, basically.
Yeah, permafrost mainly.
I mean, so I would, because tar pits are very unique to certain locations. So I would assume not that it's common, but permafrost would be like slightly more common than finding like a tar pit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those northern regions of Russia, and you know, the permafrost zone stretches all the way around the world. But so like the permafrost makes up, you know, like 90% of those areas besides the mountains.
Those creatures die, and it's the like coldest part of the ice age. I mean, they freeze. I mean, they preserve, especially if they like fall in water or something. I mean, I would assume that would help preserve it even more if they like drown and freeze over somehow. I mean,
mm-hmm. And a lot of those areas, it's a lot like what you would see near, you know, Fairbanks today up in Alaska, where you have a lot of tundra area where it's a little flatter and, you know, the animals can go out and graze, but the temperature still plummets even during the summer. And so, you know, if those animals passed away like that, only we're talking even colder back then, but it wouldn't take long for those animals to freeze. And if it was closer to winter, then they're soon going to be completely frozen solid, buried with snow. And as the, you know, the plant material from that summer's bloom would, you know, collapse and decay around it, and it would become soil. It would just permanently encase them, and then it would get deeper and deeper, and they'd just be, you know, frozen for time immemorial. So,
and that, because fossilization is already a very unique and very specific process, but like that takes fossilization and adds freezing on top of it, which would make it way even more unique. I don't even think that's proper English.
Yeah, but yeah, it's certainly an interesting depositional environment.
Yeah,
because I mean, clearly, like outside of the horn, like the skull would be preserved, and femur and hip bones and things like that would be just preserved. Because I mean, dinosaur fossils are preserved. I would likely assume that you'd find those. But so, I mean, most of these things are found without horns, right?
Right. Yeah. Because the, you know, the, just like with dinosaurs, the hard parts last longer, right? So, you know, when an animal or an organism dies, the last parts to decay are, you know, the teeth. They're probably the hardest parts in the body, which is why we find teeth so prevalent in the fossil record. That's the most prevalent thing we find. Then you're talking about the bones. That's the second most prevalent thing in the fossil record for, you know, most vertebrate fossils. Invertebrates, it would be the carapace or the shell or, you know, those types of things that were calcified. And then very rarely do you get that soft tissue preservation, but the hardest of the soft tissues would be, and I'm, if I had hair, it would be the hair, which, it, you know, I got it here. You know, it would be the hair first because it's a little harder than just the skin and things. And so that's why those horns would sometimes be preserved. And then the last thing that you would find preserved would be the skin or the internal organs that are the softest and the first to decay, most prone to bacteria.
So it kind of decays from the inside out?
A lot of organisms do because, I mean, our guts are already full of bacteria. And so when an organism dies, the Egyptians had that part figured out. When they would go about mummification, they would remove those internal organs right away because they're wet and they're full of bacteria and they start to break down almost immediately upon death. And so if you can get those out, then the rest of the body is much slower to decay.
And that's a really weird thing to think about, because you think about it decaying and you're like, oh, it would go outside in, but I mean, your stomach's always fighting itself, isn't it? So, I mean, if you die, I mean, your stomach wins and then it just kind of decays the rest of you. I mean, and then I guess on top of that, assuming maybe it didn't die in the winter, you get predators ripping it apart. So that on top of it, I mean, granted, I don't think many predators would eat the horn, but.
No, but. But you do lose a lot of the skull material first, because you've got, and you find this with any fossil deposition, skulls are usually the hardest part to find. And that's because you've got a big thing in the body, you've got a little thing in the neck, and then you've got another big thing attached to it. And because you've got this little thing that we call a neck that's trying to hold these two big things together, that's usually the weakest spot in the body. And so whether it was the environment that was forcing the deceased animal or whatever it was to be moved around, or predators or whatever, just those forces of that movement are going to pull those two heavy things apart. And so we don't find a lot of skulls, you know, when you're talking dinosaurs, that's the hardest part to find. We find a lot of the rest of the material because it stuck together pretty well. In the Green River Formation, we find a lot of birds and turtles and things, but they're missing their heads. And they're missing their heads because, you know, they'd either float on the surface and that heavy thing that we call a head would fall off because of that weak point in the neck, or it would be hanging down and a predator would take it. And so you get that a lot. So, any material from the head is going to be the least common, and especially if it's those soft bits. And the other thing is predators like to eat things that are easy first. The easiest part is going to be your midsection, your stomach and all those stomach contents. But then you've got a lot of nutrients locked up in this skull. And so your predators like, your hyenas and lions and all of those critters that have these teeth that can crush, they're going to go after the side of the skull first because you've got these big chewing muscles. And then you got this soft, squishy brain inside that's just loaded with nutrients. And so they would, you know, do whatever they could to crush that skull and go in after those soft bits inside, because it's a thin bone that's covering it up and it's not hard and gristly like the muscles that have been worked out a lot. So that's the other reason you don't find those a lot.
And I mean, to also add on to that, I mean, if something is to like scare the predator away, I mean, there's probably a chance that it would quickly grab something and run. So if there's like something else with more meat on it, it would probably target that too. I mean, so yeah, you get like an arm or a bite or like a bicep or the thigh or something, it would rip that apart first because it's more meat than work. It kind of evens out a little bit more. So, I mean,
yeah, the thing that a predator has to look out for is the return on investment. So if it takes more energy to get the nutrients, that's not very efficient. If you can get the same nutrients for less energy, that makes a lot more sense. You see that behavior right now. It's been kind of in the media lately, but with sharks, for example. So the great white shark, they have a liver that, you know, might weigh 500 pounds because sharks have giant livers. Well, orcas have figured that out now. And so orcas have started attacking great white sharks, and the only thing they eat is the liver, because it's this giant nutrient-rich organ that takes very little effort to get to, and then they just discard the rest of it because it's not worth the energy that it takes to try to extract the nutrients from the rest of the body. And, you know, I think prehistoric animals were the same way. They were looking for that best return on investment. whatever they could eat that was going to give them the most nutrients for the least exertion of energy, that's where they were going to go.
So probably the stomach area then.
Yep. Yep.
And I mean, you get something like a woolly rhinoceros and they got, I mean, these things have very thick skulls. So, I mean, it's not going to be easy to just go through it. Also those horns. I mean, if this thing is still alive, it's going to be waving its horns at you and it's going to be like, yeah, it's not really worth being skewered for what? A little bit of brain matter. I mean, so get to the side, go to the stomach, the neck, because they would have huge necks to support their heads. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of like modern bulls or T-Rex. I mean, so those kind of things, like I would assume legs and – so you find rib cage and spine kind of together more, right?
Somewhat. You know, you'll find like the big you know, thoracics and dorsal vertebrae, depending on what kind of creature you're looking at. A lot of times those, you'll find those a little more commonly than you'll find like the cervical vertebrae, like Seth mentioned, or the, you know, like the tail. Because, you know, there's a lot less muscle and tendons holding those parts together. But yeah, it's pretty rare to find anything articulated.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, I say more common, but it's already pretty rare. So whatever more common for rare would be. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if it's like a smaller predator and there is a bigger predator around, it would probably take off limbs, chunks of whatever flesh it can to kind of scurry off with so it still has a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, things like arms, legs, tails, even I would say ribs and parts of the neck, I mean, would probably be torn out, torn away, and carried off. Or in many cases, like a flood, those parts would kind of break off more easily, since there's kind of, instead of bone on bone, it's just like bone ligament and then bone, it would rip off, I would assume. I mean,
yeah, so like something I always pay attention to when I'm out in the field, you know, there's always ranch animals dying, horses, cows, and so, you know, there'll be skeletons and carcasses out on the prairies, and you know, like you come 1 month and you'll see most of the animals still together, maybe the heads off a little ways. And then you show up 2 months later and the limbs are all you know, scattered. The rib cage will still be there, some of the vertebrae. And then you put like seasons into that equation, and that does a lot to break down like the remaining connections. And you know, you come back the next year and it's just a pile of ribs and a couple vertebrae. And if you kind of input that into like these formations, that gives you a good perspective on like, you know, this creature didn't just lay down and die and get covered with sediment. Like,
that's a very rare like occurrence. I mean, that's like one in a billion probably. Mm-hmm. And that's probably being generous. I mean, it would have to like drown, go to the bottom of a lake, and then it like sediment covers it and then immediately like dries out or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And I think, you know, that's one thing that we're fortunate up in the Green River Formation anyway, is that we do find most of our fossils articulated, which is incredibly rare. I mean, it's beyond rare, but it's because of the deposition environment. That ancient lake, there's a couple of different theories out there, but the most prevalent is that the bottom of the lake had two things going on. One, it was anaerobic, meaning there was no oxygen. And number two, there was a little bit of hydrogen sulfide down there. So it killed all of the bacteria that would normally break an organism down. So they would sink to the bottom. And because the bacteria and things that would typically be present that would break an organism down weren't there, they would just sit on the bottom and be covered. Huh. Whereas in a terrestrial environment, it's almost impossible to find a scenario in which, unless they're covered almost instantaneously, you're going to find articulated specimens. And which I think is what makes, you know, places like, you know, here in Utah, we've got a couple of places like the Cleveland Lloyd Quarry, where we do find a lot of articulated specimens. Now, that's a place you can go see. It's really cool. I would recommend anybody to go check it out. But that was what we call a predator trap. And the reason it's called a predator trap is it was most likely either a swamp or a bog where prey animals initially would get trapped in that mud. And then you would have the predators come in and try to eat it. And then pretty soon they're trapped and they sink. And so you have layer upon layer of animal that have gone into that environment and been quickly covered up. And so you end up with a lot of complete skeletons, but that's almost an impossibility, I think, in most environments that, that we find fossils in.
Was that like a quicksand type of deal? Can they tell that by the type of sediment?
They think it was actually more like that particular area. They think was more like a swamp or a bog. It's more of like a siltstone almost.
Interesting.
Whereas down on Escalante Grand Staircase, they have a raptor block that they pulled out. That's a block of Utah raptor skeletons. And that one is a sandstone that they figure was quicksand. So we have actually two almost identical scenarios happening. One was Jurassic, one was Cretaceous, a different type of dinosaurs, but the same scenario where they were both predator traps. One was quicksand, one was more of a bog, and yet we're finding a lot of those complete associated skeletons. And the other cool thing that those can teach us is that more allosaurs have been found in the Cleveland Lloyd Quarry than just about anywhere else combined. There have been over 75 skeletons pulled out of that quarry, but they range from very young juveniles to full-grown adults. And what they're finding with this raptor block is the same thing, that it's got a range of juvenile up to adults, which means that perhaps, and this is not, you know, any kind of fact, it can only be, theorized that dinosaurs may have been much more social animals, especially the predators, than we thought. They may have acted a lot more like wolves and some of those types of carnivores, lions and things, and stayed together a lot more than maybe we initially thought, where in a lot of deposition environments, we don't get that experience. We don't get to see how the hunting may have occurred and which animals were associated with other animals. We don't get that. And that I think has been a real difficulty for perhaps like, let's take Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? The most famous of all dinosaurs. It's really hard to figure out any life attributes of that animal because most of what we find are either isolated elements or perhaps if we get really lucky, even an isolated skeleton, but we have yet to find, anything that really indicates, you know, either hunting or scavenging behavior. We really don't find that because the environment wasn't quite as suitable for that. The big difference between, the Jurassic and the Cretaceous was actually a lot drier than the Jurassic. And we know that based on the fauna and the flora that lived during that time. We can kind of see the differences. And now that's not saying during the Cretaceous there aren't wet areas, and hopefully someday maybe we'll find a predator trap or we'll find something, maybe even a volcanic lava flow. We know we have these preserving organisms all around the world where those animals were encased in that lava or trapped in that sediment. And they were doing something part of their natural behavior, and we'll have that instance captured in time, or at least some associations captured, so we can make a little bit more of an educated guess as to what they might have lived like. Right now, you know, the big debate, I think, with Tyrannosaurus is, was it a scavenger? Was it a predator? And because we don't have any of that anecdotal evidence, we're left to just make our best guesses. I mean, you know, in all likelihood, it was like any carnivore, and it probably did a little bit of both. Most carnivores, if they have an opportunity to kill something, they're going to do it. If they have an opportunity to scavenge, they're going to do it. But yeah, so, you know, a lot of those stories we get to tell ourselves by the deposition environments.
So you have both worked with dinosaur and mammal. So the Ice Age was clearly not as far back as the Mesozoic or Jurassic, Cretaceous, Triassic, the main dinosaur block. So do you find it easier to find more articulated things in from that Ice Age period because it wasn't that long ago, or is it just kind of still the same deal?
You know, so like the Age of Mammals kind of started in the, like, you know, in the Eocene. And so one of the most famous fossil localities in the world is kind of out here in South Dakota into Wyoming, Nebraska. It's called the White River Formation. And that's about, you know, it ranges from like 35 million to 22. And, you know, there's a lot of articulated fossils found in that formation. But it really just comes down to the depositional environment of the time. You know, there were a lot of volcanic eruptions occurring at that time. And the White River wasn't necessarily, it didn't preserve much for ash. But, you know, like a volcano goes off and it deposits 50 feet of ash 100 miles upstream. And so that ash washes down and it builds up over time. And so that's what a lot of the White River Formation is. So you get a lot of sedimentation occurring, and that in turn leads to more articulated remains being found. So it really comes down to just whatever situation is occurring.
Location, basically.
Location.
Yeah. Luck of the draw. If they were in the right place at the right time, they preserved, and that's a very small percentage, really, no matter which time period you look at. You do have a few mass extinctions and mass die-offs. I need to back up a couple steps. When I say mass extinction, I should talk about mass extinction that occurred instantaneously versus a general mass extinction, right? The dinosaurs dying 65 million years ago. Well, that extinction could have taken place over 10 million years. We're in the middle of a mass extinction right now that, you know, started at the end of the Ice Age, and we're still going. But we do have specific instances where we have mass mortalities of individuals. The Cambrian is a good example of that. We have some trilobites during the Cambrian that the Elrathia, for example, is possibly the most prolific trilobite in the world. And it is that way because all of those trilobites died, the majority of them died in a series of specific incidents. Well, we don't know what those were because they're really isn't much else preserved because the rock is so old and has been, you know, under heat and pressure for so long that we're not able to tell exactly what caused those mass die-offs. But we do know something that happened and caused that. The formation that we dig in Wyoming, we can see several mass mortality layers. We know exactly where those layers are as we go through our strata extracting fossils. So we know when we get to this layer, as soon as we pop that open, we're going to find dozens, if not hundreds, of fish on that layer, along with just about anything else. Those mass die-offs occurred typically because of volcanic eruptions. Or a couple of those layers, occurred because of turnover in the lake, which we see in modern lakes, really deep lakes that have no oxygen on the bottom and chemicals on the bottom. They do something that's called turnover, where that cold water on the bottom and the warm water on the top, for whatever reason, switch places, and it would have brought that unoxygenated water off and killed everything that was up here, and it all would have sunk down. And so, you know, in certain instances, we'll find those mass die-offs, and you'll find incredible preservation of the fossils, but that's an even more rare and really uncommon example. You think about the 4.5 billion years the Earth's been around, and we assume that life, starting with the Cambrian, maybe even pre-Cambrian, depending on which books you read, which literature you read, because we don't really have we don't really have many fossils from then. You think about how long the Earth's been around and how long we know that we've had life on Earth, and yet how few of those time periods we actually have a fossil record from. Very, very scant. We have just these little glimpses into just a few time periods that we're using to try to decipher the Earth's history. I look at even the Earth around us right now. Right now is a terrible time for fossil preservation. There's so many things going on in the environment right now that there are still certain locations where I think in, years from now, millions of years, we'll probably have some fossil preservation. But just the way things are occurring with the climate and everything, it's not ideal for fossils to be preserved. And how many times did that happen in the Earth's history? And what are we missing out? Even the Cretaceous, we have some really great fossils from the Cretaceous. It's probably the most well-known of the periods. People know those dinosaurs. They also know the Jurassic. But really, we have just this tiny, tiny snapshot of maybe 5 to 10 million years at the most in the Cretaceous. Well, what happened the other 20 million years, the other 20 plus million years of the Cretaceous? We don't know. And it's pretty wild to think how much we don't know and what is not preserved and what may still actually be out there.
So I guess, do smaller creatures preserve better? Because you brought up like fish, like if it's like a smaller fish, does it preserve better than like a sauropod?
If you're in a unique environment like the Green River Formation, that's a pretty specific example. Generally speaking, though, if you're looking at more of like a steady depositional environment, like let's say the Hell Creek Formation, where you have streams, you find fish fossils, amphibian fossils, but you also have these giant dinosaurs. It's much more common to find large dinosaurs articulated than it is fish. I only know of a few examples of actual articulated fish being found in the Cretaceous, in the Hell Creek Formation, up at that Tanis site in North Dakota, where it's been in the news a lot lately, where they think it was caused by a giant tsunami from the Chicxulub meteorite impact. They have sturgeon and paddlefish that are just like lined up like sardines in a can. So again, that's a unique example. You don't just get fish preserved. So,
and I mean, obviously something with like a harder shell would preserve something easier than like a mostly flesh kind of blob thing.
Mm-hmm. So, right. Like we find very few fossils of cephalopods that did not have shells. So your octopus and your squid, we do find their beaks and occasionally we find them, they find some over in Lebanon and, some in Germany occasionally, but because they didn't have hard parts, we really don't find them where we find a lot of their contemporaries. We find, you know, more of the fish and things that lived at the same time. And, you know, jellyfish is another example. We find a lot of jellyfish in Maison Creek, but that's one of the few places where, for some reason, jellyfish preserve their impressions. And it's not really the jellyfish fossilized. It's we have an impression from a jellyfish laying on the bottom. So.
So something versus like a jellyfish versus like a horseshoe crab, you're going to find like the actual shell of the horseshoe crab and versus the just impression of the jellyfish.
Right. And I think that's a big difference too. You know, some people, are under the assumption that all fossils, you know, have been replaced by stone, you know, mineral replacement, whatever we want to call it. But a lot of the ammonites from even the Jurassic and the Cretaceous, it's still the original shell that we find on those ammonites as they've been preserved, which I think is incredible that that shell has been preserved for tens, if not even hundreds of millions of years. And we have the actual shell that's preserved. The only other time we really get the other than, you know, Pleistocene and more modern fossils that we actually get the preserved organism, which is what we call that type of fossil, is amber. And amber is possibly one of my favorite types of fossils because we get the actual preserved organism. And we know there are some really cool things that have come out of what's now Myanmar, used to be called Burma. They have Cretaceous amber deposits over there, and they have found dinosaur parts. They have found tail, they've found a skull, they've found limbs, feathers. They've found feathers, and it's the actual preserved pieces of the organism. Like it's an actual dinosaur tail. That tail has not been turned to stone. That is an actual tail preserved in amber with all the feathers still attached, which to me is mind-boggling that we have something like that.
So I guess with that, is it like... Well, obviously it's the tail and the feather, but is it like the meat on there, like the flesh, the all that?
Yeah, it still has the flesh, the bones, everything is still preserved. So they can do an X-ray. They've done CT scans on them, and they're able to show exactly what it looks like layer by layer as they go down through that that fossil, which is pretty incredible.
It's a very unique
and
beyond just the word rare, I feel like wouldn't even describe that. I mean, that's such a unique thing. I mean,
yep.
We don't have just like thousands of those that we have found. I mean,
right.
We probably have like five to 10 total.
Right. It's very limited. You know, the other thing I'm waiting for, and I think it'll be found someday. If someone is on it enough to recognize it, and it would be completely by accident. So you're familiar with Pompeii, right?
Yes.
Pompeii was a city where we had Krakatoa, the volcano erupted, and the volcanic ash covered the people there they died.
You can see
their skeletons were preserved, but what it did was create a three-dimensional cast of their body in the exact position they were in when they died. Well, that's probably not a one-off event. In the billions of years the Earth's been around, or even hundreds of millions of years that we know dinosaurs were around, chances are pretty good that that happens to dinosaurs as well. And I'm just waiting for somebody to go into that deposit and find those three-dimensional impressions of dinosaurs and just completely blow all of our minds, because they may look absolutely nothing like what we think they look like. But it's going to have to be somebody that's really on top of it, because we don't typically go look in igneous deposits for fossils, for dinosaurs, right? We don't. That's just not where they're found most commonly. We don't find them in lava rock. But someday somebody's going to be cutting a road through, and they're going to find these weird pockets, and they're going to say, "What is this?" And somebody will recognize it, and we will, I think, have our first three-dimensional representations of what these animals look like in real life. So that's my life goal, is to still be alive when that happens.
I forgot which sauropod specifically, and I want to say it's Mimentosaurus, but I feel like that's wrong. where it was just like found while like in China, they were just building a highway and they're like, we found these big bones. We don't know what they go to. And somebody's like, can we dig here?
Yeah. And that's how most fossil discoveries are made. The Green River Formation was made when they were putting the railroad through. They were near Green River, Wyoming, and they were cutting the hillsides away so that they could lay tracks. And they started finding all these fish fossils, and they sent them back to, believe it or not, they sent some of those fossils back to Edward Cope, and he started describing them. He named the formation after Green River, Wyoming, because that's where the railroad was at the time. And now we have that formation. So a lot of them are made just by industrial progress, industrialization, and the modern world, which is kind of cool.
Construction and yep. And I mean, construction companies hire those because, I mean, like I visited somebody, they were more archaeology than paleontology, but you can't build on certain sites if you find like a certain amount of stuff. If you find like one arrowhead or one pottery shard, of course, then you're going to be like, just build it. But if you find like a full articulated smilodon, on, they're going to be like, all right, you can't build here. We got to dig it all up, see what we find. I mean,
yeah. And so there's a fun story. I know I'm taking up all your time. I should be quiet, but one of my favorite stories is about the discovery of a mammoth called the Huntington Mammoth. So Huntington's the name of a reservoir, and it's located pretty high up in the mountains here in Utah, actually. And they were doing some work on a dam up there. There's a big reservoir, Huntington Reservoir, that they use for irrigation and to divert water into different areas of the state from up in this high mountain pass, which mammoths didn't live in the mountains. I don't know that most people know that. They didn't. They were plains animals. They liked the tundra, just like elephants. Elephants don't live up in the mountains. It's not conducive. Excuse me.
Hannibal proved they don't like mountains too.
Yeah. And so they were up there with their heavy equipment, and the guy was doing some earthwork, and he pulls out what he thinks is this big log, and he's like, that log looks really funny. So he hops off his equipment. He goes over, he looks at it, and he realizes this looks like a giant bone. What on earth is this? So he goes and, you know, he tells his supervisor, and the supervisor's like, that's a log. Just keep going. Like, no, I think this is really something weird. And the guy's like, no, come on, we got a job to do. Let's do it. Well, instead of just, you know, continuing to bulldoze through everything, he was smart enough to reach out to a couple of groups, and Utah Museum of Natural History and our state paleontologist at the time got involved and went up there. And what they realized is it was a Columbian mammoth. No other mammoth had ever been found at this elevation or even close to the elevation of this one. This one was at almost 10,000 feet. And had he just continued to dig and no one checked it out, we wouldn't have this story. Now, the other cool part of the story is, as they got up there and they started excavating the mammoth, right near it, they found the remains of a short-faced bear. And on the foot, the one leg of the mammoth, they found tooth marks where the bear had been eating the mammoth. Now, that's cool in and of itself, but when they took those bones back and they started doing radiocarbon dating, the bear ended up being about 25,000 years younger than the mammoth. And the story that they were able to put together, because this guy didn't just keep dozing through it, was that this mammoth had died and actually been frozen.
Wow.
And probably had laid there, and eventually its leg was sticking out of either the permafrost, the soil, the ice, whatever it was. And this bear came along, and this bear was old. Its teeth were really worn down, and it saw this free meal. So it had sat there and actually eaten on this mammoth until it eventually just laid down and passed away next to it.
Wow. One last meal.
So, yeah, pretty wild story.
That's such a good, unique story. And, I mean, I'm sure just like people who just have like paleontology and museums, they all – have their stories because they know exactly where to search, got their dig sites. But I mean, there's got to be hundreds of thousands of stories like that where somebody found some crazy thing while building whatever. I mean, railroad tracks, dams, roads. Mm-hmm. You take up a lot of space with that. And so, I mean, I could only imagine what you could find.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some amazing fossils still buried and a lot of stories still to be uncovered that humans will probably never, you know, never be there to experience.
No, probably not. We in how many ever years, a thousand or so years, we'll be excavating I-50 whatever and calling it some crazy new thing.
Right.
Yep. Have to create some new theories about us ancient humans.
Yeah, exactly.
I know y'all are really busy people, so I don't want to take up too much of y'all's time. I mean, you got Mosasaur to go work on. And yep. You got something to work on, I'm very sure. I mean, so I'm going to let y'all go and close this out. And I'm really thank y'all for taking time out of y'all's day to come talk to me and come talk to everybody about your experiences and at Tucson and just in general about dinosaurs. I mean, it's always an honor to have y'all on.
It was fun. And I'd recommend anybody that's watching, jump on and look at that Rex block. It really is one of the coolest things I think I've ever seen in my life. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Rex Creek Discoveries down there and Fossil Shack right there. Go check them out on Instagram. I'm sure they got TikTok and all that too. They got a lot of amazing content and I really suggest y'all go check them out. So I guess if y'all got to go, y'all got to go. I mean,
all right. Okay. Well, it was nice talking to you, Seth.
Thank you. Good to see you too. You guys have a good afternoon.
You too.
We'll see you later.
And that was about the Tucson fossil mineral, whatever you want to call it, show. There's the Rex Creek. I was trying to find it. The Rex Creek Instagram channel. Go check that out. Also, you got Fossil Shack too. I forgot to mention it. He's definitely gonna watch this. I know he will. Thank you so much for these. This is not all he gave me. There's his Instagram. I got some stuff in my case and other places. I've posted about it. I've done an episode about it. So, again, thank you so much, Seth, for the amazing fossil mystery crate, whatever you want to call it. That was so kind of you, and I really enjoyed opening that. While you're checking out Instagram pages, like I said, I posted about it. So go check out my Instagram page where you can see all that content. You can see what's coming out. We got a big tournament thing where I do a battle every Friday. Last episode, at the time of recording was Majungasaurus and Ripperivinator. I should have another episode or two out by the time this one comes out. But yeah, and if, like we kept talking about, there's a lot of amazing museums out there. If you want to go on a trip and see them, go check out my boy, Dinosaur Trips, a really amazing guy. He's got a lot of amazing trips where he takes you behind the scenes at museums and even takes you on to dig sites and things. Here's Utah and Colorado, the Red Rocks and Raptors trips he's doing with Dr. Brian Curtis. Amazing guy. A little sneak peek on something coming up. I ordered a Majungasaurus skull for him. Majungasaurus episode will be coming out one day very soon. Don't know when I will do that. Or when I'll have to upload that and all that. But it will be coming out. You can quote me on that. But yeah, you can go on a dinosaur trip. Go see all these amazing museums. If you want to see my content a little bit early, go check out my YouTube page. As you can see, there's Sky down there. Go check out my YouTube page. I try to post everything a day or two in advance. And if you want all of that in one place, go check out my website. I have it in there. You can see my YouTube, my Instagram, all the previous episodes on there. But yeah, I'm your host, Eric Crawford. I'll see you all next time. Thank you, Seth. Thank you, Rex Creek Discoveries, Fossil Shack, Fossil Crates. Thank you all so much for watching, supporting, and coming on the show and talking to me. Y'all are so amazing, and I love always just hearing stories. So thank you so much. And again, I'm your host, Eric Crawford, signing off. This is in Prehistoric Life Podcast. Remember, keep it prehistoric. Goodbye.